All right, good morning. This is Bio 231, and it is March 9th, and this is on the test. It worked sort of last time. Good. Worked this time too. Let's see. So today is the first day sort of back at work after the time change. And so I know those people that had that 7:30 lab this morning, that was like having a lab at 6:30. So anyway, I think we all should give everybody a round of applause that made it to class at 6:30 this morning. Congratulations. All right, but we'll settle into the next schedule pretty quickly probably. All right, so the next test. Somebody asked me about what's going to be on the next test. It's going to be chapters 10, 11, and 12. So only three chapters. And I think we're going to have it on the 25th. Yeah, the 25th. You know, maybe that would be a Wednesday. That would be a Wednesday, the 25th. Yeah, but you got to keep coming to class because this is just a tentative schedule, right? But that's what I might move it up. I don't know, maybe. Okay. Oh wow! I don't know when the next lab test is. I'd have to look at the schedule, and the schedule that's in the syllabus was given to me, and it's not the right schedule. The one that's in your lab manual is the correct one. No, I'm not really following the discussion. I was just talking about the lecture test. Okay, the lecture test on the 25th, but maybe after class. If you want to look at the schedules, I'll be happy to scrutinize it a little bit more in detail. Okay, so we're talking about muscle. We're done with the introductory chapter, and we're going to start talking about muscles. And I really want to spend a lot of time with nomenclature, because with muscles, you might have a tendency to memorize everything. And that's fine if you have photographic memory, but there are some tricks in understanding what the actions of muscles are and how to name muscles. All right, in this class, we're not going to ask you to know the innervation, the nerves that go to various muscles. But if you're really interested, you could go ahead and learn maybe the names of some nerves. But we're interested in actions, origins, insertions, and the names of muscles. Okay, so I'm going to give you some guidelines on how, at least for my mind, right, it makes it easier as opposed to just memorizing everything. So I want to talk about how we go about naming muscles and then by where they are in the body, what actions they produce. So you don't have to memorize the action of every particular muscle. Okay? All right. Now somebody wrote me an email about homework assignment number 11. Okay? And the answer keys just automatically pop up. I programmed that before the semester. So if you're really diligent and are pressing ahead with the pre-lecture reading assignments, the keys don't pop up until about the day of the lecture. So we can double check with that. All right. But number 11 is now posted. I double check that one. But 12 is not available. But 12 probably might be available tonight. I don't know. I could, if you're really interested to know, I could check and see how I programmed it to appear. All right. So the things that you should be working with before the test is I think that study plan is really important for you to get a handle on how much time you need to study. And as a matter of fact, I would start to like to get some feedback from students as to how much they are studying. And the pre-lecture reading assignment, I'm sure, helps you a lot in lecture. Okay, so if you want to show me your pre-lecture reading assignments, I know I have some students that come by and say, oh, I got a question about this or that. I think that really helps them for the lecture test, probably the lab tests as well. Okay, there is another open lab this week sometime. It's Friday. Yeah, it's Friday. Okay. Yeah, so it's this coming Friday, so it's not this Saturday, it's Friday, probably from, 10 to 1? 10 to 1, so that might help with the next practicum coming up, but I don't have on the tip of my tongue when the next practicum really is. And then here's a sign-in sheet for this week. Okay. All right, so does anybody have any questions? No? Okay, it's Bio 231, March 9th, and we're still talking about muscles, chapter 11. Okay, so last time I think we talked about the structure of muscle. So if we look at a whole muscle and look at the next level that has to be used as a building block to make a whole muscle, what's the compartment of within a muscle called? It's called a fascicle. That's right. So, and what's the building block of a fascicle? A muscle fiber. Yeah, so if we put a bunch of muscle fibers together into some kind of bundle, that makes a fascicle. And we can see fascicles with our naked eye. And so a lot of times we can name muscles by the fascicle arrangement that they have. All right, so muscles have different shapes and actions because of different arrangements of fascicles or the patterns that we can see. All right, there are some that are circular muscles. Now, what kind of muscles are we talking about here? How many different kinds of muscles are there? I mean, generally speaking, how many different kinds of muscles are there? There's three, and there are skeletal, voluntary control, cardiac involuntary, smooth muscle, involuntary control. So our whole discussion here is going to be covering skeletal muscle in particular. All right, and here is a circular skeletal muscle. So what kind of control do you have over this particular example, the orbicularis oris? That's voluntary control, right? That doesn't contract all by itself. There are circular smooth muscles, but those usually we call those sphincters. All right, so a sphincter is going to be different than an orbicularis because an orbicularis is under voluntary control. Sphincter is under involuntary control with maybe a couple exceptions to that rule. All right, parallel. This is where the fascicles are short. Okay, so maybe I'll show you some examples. So here is an orbicularis. Two locations would be what, around the mouth, that would be the oris, and then the circular muscle around the eyes would be called the oculi, orbicularis oculi. So anytime you hear that word orbicularis, you know it's a circular skeletal muscle, okay, not a smooth muscle. All right, then here we have a couple fascicle arrangements, strap-like. All right, so it just kind of looks like a belt. It doesn't have pointy ends. And a good example of that would be the sternocleidomastoid. And then here is parallel fascicle arrangement again, but this is what we call a fusiform arrangement. A fusiform is a particular shape. It means it has pointy ends with a bulge in the middle. So if you think of an animal that has a fusiform shape, what kind of animal has a fusiform shape to it? Usually they're fast. Okay. Cats, maybe, but they have those legs that are sticking out of them. So I'm thinking something long with pointy ends without legs sticking out of them. For instance, like a porpoise, okay, or a seal has a fusiform shape. All right, so a fusiform muscle should kind of connotate or conjure those kinds of images in your mind. Okay, a whale or a porpoise. Convergent. Right, a good example of a convergent muscle fascicle arrangement would be the pectoralis major. All right, where all the fascicles insert into a common tendon from a diffuse origin. And then we have the pinnate muscles. The pinnates sort of look like a flag hanging off of a major seam or a pole or something like that. All right, so unipennate has fascicles all pointing off of just one direction from the insertion into a common tendon. And a good example of that would be the flexor pollicis longus in the forearm. The bipennate, there's a common insertion on a tendon, but it comes off in a right as well as a left direction. So we call that bipennate. A really good example of that would be the rectus femoris muscle in your thigh. All right, and then a multipennate, we have a number of common insertions that then coalesce into finally a common insertion over here. That would be a good example of the deltoid, which covers your whole shoulder joint. All right, so these muscles provide for the multipennate, bipennate, provide for a lot of strength. All right, and the deltoid in particular means depending on which ones of these pennates right here contract, changes how the arm functions. All right, so what kind of motions can you do with your arm? Okay, so you got, what is this right here? If you go from anatomic position to raising it anterior, that's flexion, okay, and then extension, and then what else can you do? You can abduct, all right, and so, and then you can also hyperextend, okay? So the deltoid, because of these different fascicle arrangements right here, you can flex, you can abduct, you can extend, and the deltoid helps provide each of those motions, right? But if they all contract pretty much equally, then that's just going to be abduction. Okay. All right, the way that we think about muscles, there can be different motions that they are producing. A synergist muscle, or muscles that are just muscles that work together. So synergist muscles are what? At least two muscles? They're going to provide the same kind of motion. So muscles that work together to perform the same motion are synergists. Good examples of these would be the biceps brachii and the brachialis. Now, what body compartment is the biceps brachii in? It's in your arm. What part of your arm? Your anterior arm. All right, so what about the brachialis? What body compartment is that in? Okay, say forearm. Well, I don't know. Let's think a little bit more. The brachialis is just deep to the biceps brachii. All right, so the brachialis is underneath the biceps brachii, but these two muscles are in exactly the same body compartment. So that kind of gives you a hint of really what I want to tell you about today in lecture, right? And that is, you understand the motion or the action that's produced by muscle by the body compartment that it's in. So if you have two muscles and they're in the same body compartment, guess what they're going to be? They're going to be synergist muscles because they're providing the same kind of motion. All right, so the biceps and the brachialis are both for forearm flexion, important for forearm flexion. And depending on what book you actually read, right, one of those muscles is more important for producing forearm flexion than the other. And maybe you shouldn't tell me because your book doesn't give me the answer that I like. Okay, and that has to do with the prime mover. So if we have a couple synergist muscles, there's one that usually does more work in providing for that kind of motion, and we call that the prime mover. And in terms of forearm flexion, the muscle that is the prime mover is actually the brachialis muscle. Okay, it is not the biceps. So if you were to flex your forearm all day long, it's for sure the biceps brachii is working, but the brachialis is even working harder at that. And I'll give you a little hint. In lab, a lot of people get that brachialis mixed up with maybe the triceps on the practicum, okay, because it's tucked underneath the biceps, and where you would see it is right about here. That's going to be the brachialis muscle. Okay, the triceps is going to be all the way in the posterior compartment. All right, so that takes us kind of to the next concept, and that is, if all the muscles that are in the anterior arm are producing flexion of the forearm, what can you tell me about the posterior arm? Okay, those are going to be providing the antagonistic motion, which is what? Extension of the forearm. All right, and we only have one important muscle back there, and that's the triceps brachii. So to understand motion, you should really know what body compartment it's in. Okay, so muscles which work in opposition to each other are antagonists. Good examples of antagonistic muscles would be the biceps brachii for forearm flexion, and then the triceps brachii for forearm extension. All right, so, and do you need both of those muscles? Absolutely, right? So that concept of antagonism, you should appreciate, is really important for having precise control and balance over your body. Not just in terms of the musculoskeletal system, but you're going to see later on that's very important for the endocrine system and the nervous system and many other systems in the body. All right, the last kind of muscle is a general class is what we call a fixator. And a fixator is a muscle, for instance, that doesn't produce a motion, but it just holds bones in a certain relationship so that other muscles can provide the proper kind of motion between them. Okay, a good example of that would be muscles that fix the scapula in position while the upper appendage moves. Like when the biceps contracts or the triceps contracts, the only way that those origins are working properly is if the scapula doesn't move. If the scapula moves, then that muscle is not going to have an origin and you won't have a proper motion. Okay. So let's talk about nomenclature. This is going to be really important. You can breathe a big sigh of relief on the test or a practicum if you understand this information right here. All right, a lot of times we'll name a muscle by location. And that's why it was pretty important to understand different locations of the body on that first chapter. All right, so the brachialis is in the brachium. All right, and so the brachium is just your arm. All right, intercostals are muscles that are between the ribs because costa means rib. All right, so when you see these terms, you automatically know where these muscles are. Sometimes we name muscles by their shape. For instance, some muscles are circular in shape. What would we call a circular muscle? Orbicularis, right? There is one that's very triangular in shape. And so we call that the deltoid. Okay, the deltoid muscle, yeah.
So what is the capsule one? Because I do mine we see a few hours, a few minutes ago, another one like that. Sandwich shape, and it's called capsule.
Okay, I'm not quite sure I understood. But we can't have two muscles, for instance, with the same name. So we have to change the name maybe a little bit. Right, we can't have two different muscles that are called deltoid unless we modify it somehow. All right, we'll see how we can modify these things just a little bit. Trapezius is sort of triangular in shape. Maybe the latissimus dorsi could be considered a little bit triangular as well. So sometimes you do have to study these names a little bit. We can modify names by talking about their relative size. All right. For instance, the gluteal muscles. There's a gluteus maximus, gluteus minimus. All right. There's a gluteus longus and brevis. Guess which one is the shortest? The brevis. All right. And the biggest is the gluteus maximus. Right. Okay. Sometimes we name muscles by the directions of fascicles of the muscle fibers. For instance, rectus abdominis. Rectus means straight up and down. I think I was reading a textbook, I don't know if it was yours or not, but they came up with a different term for rectus, I'm not sure. But rectus just means straight. The fascicle arrangement is just straight up and down. Or it might be just straight right and left. Okay. And you can even have, instead of right and left, you can even have muscles that are oblique. So oblique just means that it's not aligned along one of the main axes of the body, but it's angulated. So the external oblique is one of the external layers of the stomach muscles, and it is what? Angulated. Okay. And this is probably the most helpful right here. Location of attachment points. As long as you know your anatomy of the skeletal system. For instance, sternocleidomastoid muscle. When you're first starting to look at muscles, this is kind of an intimidating term, but actually once you learn how to read the names of muscles, this is actually very reassuring because you know what the origin and insertion is. All right, so sternocleidomastoid tells us what the origin and insertion is right in the name of this word. So where's the sternum at? That's a bone, all right? And clido stands for clavicle. Where's the sternum and clavicle? They're associated with each other. And when we name muscles, the first part of the word is going to be the origin, and the second part of the word is going to be the insertion. So what end of the muscle is the origin? The more movable or less movable end? The less movable. Okay? Right. So here is a sternocleidal mastoid. All right? The last part of the term is mastoid. What have you learned about mastoid? Where's some mastoid region? Like, for instance, the mastoid process of the temporal bone. What's the function of the mastoid process? Muscle attachment. Guess what muscle attaches there? The sternocleidal mastoid. So there's a lot of ways that you can relate to this term. You don't always just have to memorize. Sternocleidal mastoid. All right, let me see if I can find a picture of some of these things. Okay, let me go to maybe, here's a really good picture. Sternocleidal mastoid. So here is a sternocleidal mastoid. You can see that it has two origins, one on the sternum, the other on the clavicle. But both of these bellies insert into the mastoid process of the temporal bone. Okay? And this muscle is bilateral. That means that you have one on one side of your neck and one on the other side. And when they both contract, okay, what's the motion that is produced when they both contract? The mastoid process is going to be pulled down to the sternum and the clavicle. So your head is going to do a yes kind of motion. Okay? All right, so don't forget, when you know the origin and insertion, when that muscle contracts, the origin and insertion of those two bones are going to approximate each other. They're going to be pulled together. All right, but since you have that muscle bilaterally, the sternocleidal mastoids are also important for rotating the head. Because, for instance, if you just contract one, say on the right side of your body, like this, all right, that's going to rotate your head laterally in that direction of the muscle that is contracting. So if both contract equally, it produces a yes motion. If one contracts while the other relaxes, that produces a no motion. All right, so that's the sternocleidal mastoid. A really nice, easy teaching example of origin and insertion. Now there's something that's sort of an exception to this muscle right here, and that is in most places in the body, okay, the insertion is inferior and the origin is superior. I don't think I've ever asked a question like that on a test, but people might ask you all the time, give me a name of a muscle that doesn't follow the general rule of the insertion being inferior and the origin being superior. And a good example of that would be the sternocleidal mastoid. Most muscles in your body, if you're just going to take a wild guess, if you're not familiar, if they ask you for origin and insertion, always say that the origin is superior and the insertion is inferior. That's usually how your body works, but not in the case of the sternocleidal mastoid muscle. Another way that we can name muscles is by the number of origins. For instance, the biceps brachii, okay, has two origins. And the triceps brachii has three, right? And the quadriceps has four. All right. Furthermore, we might want to modify these terms by saying biceps brachii, because that tells us what? The location. So we might include the number of origins along with the location of a muscle to name it. And then here is something, too, that will simplify your understanding or learning of muscles, and that is a lot of muscles we name by the motion that they produce, right? Like flexor, extensor. And the only way that this makes a lot of sense is to know what body compartment that particular muscle is in, right? So you do have to know what motions are produced by different body compartments. That's one thing that you should memorize. All right, so let's go back to, for instance, back. All right, right here. So here you have a slide of somebody's upper appendage and lower appendage. And we can see a posterior compartment in the arm, a posterior compartment in the forearm. And here is an anterior compartment in the arm and forearm. All the muscles in the posterior arm are going to be extensors. Every single one is going to be an extensor. All the muscles in the anterior arm, since it's the opposite body compartment, is a flexor, forearm flexor. All right. Now, that's not too complicated for the arm because you don't have a whole lot of muscles, but let's move to another body compartment where if you're going to learn all the muscles, you might have about 50 to know. All right, so let's look at the anterior compartment of the forearm compared to the posterior compartment of the forearm. You don't have, we really simplified it in lab. I think you have to know maybe three or so different muscles in the anterior and posterior forearm. But nonetheless, all of the muscles in the anterior forearm are going to produce what kind of motion? It's going to be one of two. Just like the anterior arm, it's going to be flexion. All right, so these muscles of the forearm are either going to flex the wrist or flex the digits, which are what? Your fingers. All right, so if there's a muscle that flexes the wrist, right, we call that a flexor carpi, okay, muscle. Or, and it could be medial, could be lateral. And if it's lateral, that would be a flexor carpi radialis because the bone in your lateral bone in your forearm is the radius. If it's a medial muscle, it's going to be what? A flexor carpi ulnaris. But if it doesn't go to a carpal, if it goes to a finger, we would call that the flexor digitorum muscle, flexor digitorum. But all the muscles in the anterior forearm right here are going to be responsible for flexion. Yeah. Oh, that's a pretty interesting question. Okay. Is that extension or abduction? I don't know. That's sort of a trick question. Okay. You know, I would say extension. Okay. But I'll have to look and see what the correct answer is. Okay. Okay. All right, now for the leg, it's the same. All right, as long as you know what flexion and extension is. In the anterior thigh, for instance, like the quadriceps femoris, all of those muscles right there are going to work across the knee. All right, they're going to insert into the tibial tuberosity. And it's going to pull the tibial tuberosity closer to the femur right here. So those are all extensors. All the muscles in the anterior thigh are extensors. So all the muscles, for instance, in the posterior thigh are going to be antagonistic to that motion, and that is what? Flexors. Okay. Okay. And then in the anterior leg, these are all going to be dorsiflexors, right? And all those in the posterior leg are going to be the plantar flexors. All right, so it's really helpful to know muscle action by body compartment. All right, so another way, what other body compartment? How about in the anterior neck? What about all the muscles in the anterior neck? What motion is going to be produced? It's going to be, what do we call that? That's flexion of the cervical spine. So all the muscles in the posterior neck are going to be extensors of the cervical spine. Muscles in the anterior trunk are going to be flexors of the vertebral column. Muscles of the back are extensors. Okay? All right, muscles in the lateral thigh are going, when they contract, how's your leg going to move? And let's just say they go across the hip. Okay? They're going to be abductors. What about muscles in the medial thigh? These are all adductors. All right, so just appreciate the different antagonism going on there. All right, so this probably is a really good list for you just to memorize. All right, anterior neck, that's flexion, posterior neck, head, extension. Yeah, let's dissect that term a little bit. Okay. What can you tell me about the muscle extensor carpi radialis longus? All right, so it seems like a really long name, but it's really handy because it tells you almost everything that you have to know about this particular muscle. All right, so extensor. So, and carpi, let's look at that, extensor carpi. So it's going to be moving the wrist. So what kind of muscles move the wrist? Where do you find them? Do you find them in your thigh or your trunk? Okay, they're going to be forearm, right? So they're forearm. And if it's an extensor, is it going to be anterior forearm or posterior forearm? Is it going to be posterior forearm? This is where all the extensors are, okay? So extensor carpi is going to be in the forearm. And radialis means what? It's going to be one in the lateral group. So it's going to be way over here someplace. And longus just means that there are also some short ones. This happens to be the long one. And that's the easiest for you to see. And so that's why I chose that for the practicum. Okay, I think this is one for the practicum. Extensor carpi radialis. I did not guarantee it will be on your practicum, but it should be on your study list. Okay? All right, so it's going to be lateral forearm, right? And it's a long one right there on the lateral side. And so the other ones in your lab guide probably would be like the extensor carpi, what? Ulnaris? Longus? Okay. So that's how I would look at that term. Does that sort of make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so it really lays itself out for appreciation pretty easily. Okay, all right, so then again, just to get a feel for anatomy, origins and insertions, all right, the occipital frontalis, again, this is sort of like the sternocleidomastoid, all right, so here we have the origins and insertions in the name of the muscle. All right, so occipital frontalis, what is the origin? What's the origin? It's always the first part of the word, first part of the name. So the origin is going to be the occipital bone in the back of the head, and the insertion is going to be the, okay, now here you have to use a little artistic license, all right? You couldn't really just say frontal bone, because the occipital bone are sort of glued together by sutures, so your occipital bone isn't going to move, your frontal bone isn't going to move, but what does move is that this muscle inserts into the skin of your forehead, all right? So when that muscle contracts, it's not that the bones move, but it's a muscle of facial expression, right? So that raises your eyebrows, okay? Elevates the eyebrows. And you get that from the name right here. So where's that occipital frontalis? So here is the occipital belly of the occipital frontalis. All right, here's the frontal belly. And that's what raises the eyebrows. These two muscles are connected to each other with the aponeurosis. All right, the galea aponeurosis. And aponeurosis is what? Just a broad, flat, tendinous sheath. We don't have any muscle up there. And sometimes we call the occipital frontalis the epicranius. What does epi mean? Epi. On top of the cranium, right? Epicranius. All right, so a lot, sometimes some muscles have different names. All right, but you can see how that's all put together. Okay, neck muscle, sternocleidomastoid. We actually took a look at that already. All right, that's pretty easy to understand again by nomenclature, right? So the sternum and clavicle are the origin, the mastoid process of the temporal bone is the insertion. So when that muscle contracts, what bones move? Does your sternum move or does your clavicle move? What moves? The temporal bone moves, right? Your temporal bone moves. So the mastoid process is the insertion. Okay, I don't want to show you a picture of that again. Okay, upper limbs, biceps brachii. We have a long head and a short head. The long head originates from the supraglenoid tubercle. Where do you find the supraglenoid tubercle? It's right on the superior margin of the glenoid fossa, right? And let me see if I can find a picture of that. Did I pass it by? Okay. Here's a... pretty good picture. All right, so here is the biceps brachii, and you can see that it has two heads. The long head goes right through the intertubercular groove between the tubercles on the humerus, and it goes over to the glenoid fossa and originates on the tubercle that's just superior to the glenoid fossa. All right, and then the other, the short head, originates from the... What is this process on the scapula right here? This is the coracoid process on the scapula. All right, and that goes across the shoulder joint, goes all the way across the ulna, and inserts into the radial tuberosity. One of the insertions is the radial tuberosity right here. So the biceps brachii, this diagram also shows us that the action might be a little bit complicated because it goes across the elbow, causing flexion of the elbow. But what else, what other joint does the biceps move across? The shoulder joint. So the biceps is also important for, what's this motion? Flexion. Yeah, it's also important for flexion of the shoulder. All right, but its primary action is what? Mostly flexion of the elbow. All right, brachioradialis. All right, brachioradialis is right here. The origin is just the mid shaft or mid diaphysis of the humerus. And when this muscle contracts, what bone moves? Is it the humerus or is it the ulna? It's pretty much the ulna. So it causes forearm flexion. And notice that the brachioradialis only goes across the elbow. All right, so for forearm flexion, that's the most important muscle for forearm flexion. So what do we call the muscle that's the most important muscle for flexion of the forearm? That's the prime mover, right? So the brachialis is the prime mover. All right, here's another one, coracobrachialis. The origin is the coracoid process on the scapula. The insertion is the medial mid-diaphysis. All right, so what's the action of the coracobrachialis? When this muscle gets shorter, what two bones come closer together? Or what two parts of these bones? It's the humerus is going to be pulled into the coracoid process. All right, so of course this muscle, this bone right here can't get any shorter, so this is important for what? For adduction, all right, and as well as for a little bit of flexion. So that's pretty easy to see. Okay, triceps brachii. We have three origins right here, the long head, the lateral head, and medial head. And let's see if we have a good picture of it. Oh, not really. All right, so here is the triceps brachii. The long head goes all the way across the shoulder to the infraglenoid tubercle. That's underneath these muscles of the scapula. All right, and the intermediate head is right here, and the lateral head, and then the short head we can't see because it's deep. And some other examples, the lower limbs, gastrocnemius. Right, the gastrocnemius. This is the most superficial muscle in the posterior leg. And the origins are the epicondyles of the femur. So it does go across the knee, so it does provide for some flexion of the leg, but most of it occurs via the calcaneal tendon as it inserts into the calcaneus right here. So when this muscle contracts, it's going to elevate this posterior part of the calcaneus, causing your toes to point into the ground, and that motion is called plantar flexion. All right, so the gastrocnemius is an important synergist in plantar flexion. But there's also another one, and that is the soleus, which is deep to the gastrocnemius. All right, it has a common insertion into the calcaneal tendon, and then inserts into the calcaneus. So the soleus right here is also a plantar flexor. So how would we talk about the gastrocnemius and the soleus? They are synergists with each other. All right. The antagonistic muscle, here you can see this is the soleus right here. All right, so here you can see the gastrocnemius. All right, so what muscle is going to dorsiflect? What muscles will dorsiflect? So here is the anterior compartment of the leg, right? And this is the primary dorsiflexor of the leg. When it contracts, right, it's going to dorsiflect the foot. Okay. These diagrams are, I think, pretty important for you to look at a little bit, because if we just look at a transverse section across the arm, right, we see some muscles in the anterior arm and see some muscles in the posterior arm. What's going to be the relationship in terms of action between these two? Anterior, yeah, they're going to be antagonistic, so the anterior arm are going to be flexors, the posterior arm are going to be extensors. All right, so let's look over some muscles of facial expression. Okay, so we got the orbicularis oculi, orbicularis oris. All right, so what's the function of the orbicularis oculi? It closes your eyes. It prevents material from going inside your eyes. Now, what about the orbicularis oris muscle? That's so that when you chew, what doesn't happen? Yeah, make sure that food doesn't come popping out of your mouth when you chew. All right, there's a buccinator. Where's a buccinator? All right, the buccinator is deep in your cheek. All right, that's a muscle of mastication. And can you imagine what the function of the buccinator is? Okay. Yeah, it kind of tightens up your cheek, because again, if you're chewing, if you chew down on some food, it's going to have a tendency to what? Move away from underneath your teeth, but the buccinator keeps food underneath your teeth so that you can chew it, so that you can masticate it. Right? That's the function of the buccinator right there. Okay. What about other muscles for chewing, for elevating the mandible? We have the masseter, and then we have the temporalis right here, and a couple other muscles that are important for elevating the mandible, and these are the pterygoids. All right, so the origins of the pterygoids are the sphenoid bone, the pterygoid processes, the plates that are sticking down toward your mouth. Okay. And the insertion is going to be on the mandible, posterior aspects of the mandible, or the coronoid process of the mandible. So the pterygoids are for elevating the mandible, but also, since they're bilateral, you can move your mandible back and forth for grinding. And the pterygoids can also protrude your mandible out, can poke your mandible out in front of your face. All right, all these little muscles. I might put a muscle on the test that we haven't ever talked about. just so that I'll test you for nomenclature. Okay, so how do we name muscles by origin and insertion? What comes first? The origin, then insertion. So, for instance, I could pick a name like the, do I see one here? I have to pick one that's pretty obvious, all right? But glossus, right? Glossus right here, anytime you hear glossus or hypoglossal, it has to do with motion of the tongue or innervation of the tongue. So, for instance, here's a muscle that we typically don't talk about, the stylohyoid muscle. Well, it's not even on here. Let me go to the next slide. Stylohyoid muscle. Did you see it? Oh, here's stylohyoid. All right, so what could you tell me about the stylohyoid muscle? What is the origin? The styloid process of the temporal bone, and the insertion is going to be the hyoid bone. All right, so here we can see that it's cut. All right, so that's a fixator muscle. It's not going to be really moving the hyoid bone around, but for sure the temporal bone doesn't move at all when that muscle contracts. So that's an important muscle for articulation and for swallowing. And you could at least tell me what the origin and insertion is by looking at the name. Okay. So we said that muscles work best in antagonistic pairs. And in the anterior neck, we have the sternocleidomastoid. All right, so where would you look for a muscle that's antagonistic to the sternocleidomastoid? Like the posterior neck. So what kind of muscles did you have to know for posterior neck? All right, what do we have? We have the splenius capitis. All right, then splenius cervicis. I think you only have to know the splenius on your lab list. In lab, we just say the splenius. All right, so again, it's the mastoid process, but where do these muscles course to? They course posteriorly, right, to the spinous processes and transverse processes of the cervical vertebrae. So these are what motion is provided by the splenius muscles. The sternocleidomastoid is flexion. What about the splenius? Okay, it would be extension, right? Extension of the cervical spine. So that's another pair of muscles that you should probably know, right? Sternocleidomastoid and splenius capitis are antagonistic to each other because they're in opposite body compartments. Another interesting muscle that we have right here are the scalenes. And the scalenes originate on the transverse processes of the cervical spine and insert into the ribs number 1 and 2 right here. So they're going to, the insertion is the ribs, so when the scalenes contract, what happens to those ribs? They elevate. And what happens to you when the ribs elevate? What's happening inside your body? Okay. Yeah, maybe you could think of maybe shrugging your shoulders or something, but something actually more important is taking place. For instance, breathing, right? So these muscles assist in inspiration. So scalenes are important for inspiration, especially when you're hyperventilating. Or for instance, when somebody has a pathology where they have trouble breathing, for instance, like an emphysema. When somebody has emphysema, they have difficulty breathing. So they use these muscles a lot to inspire. And when you use a muscle a lot, what happens to it? It hypertrophies. Yeah, it grows. It gets bigger, right? So somebody with emphysema, sometimes you can just tell by looking at them by the musculature of their chest, right? They have very, very strong muscles in their chest, and they have that typical kind of barrel-shaped chest because those muscles are hypertrophied to help them breathe. I'm sorry?
What was the last picture?
This last picture right here? Yeah, I'm not going to go over this one right here. This is just the anterior neck, a dissection. Okay, so that's not an exam figure. Okay, so here is posterior spine, and we have hundreds of muscles in our back. But the only ones that we want you to know in here, right, are what we call the erector spinae group. Right, these erector spinae go from the ribs down to transverse processes of the thoracic and lumbar spine. And all of what's the action of all of these muscles right here? To maintain posture, but what kind of motion in particular? Are these going to be extensors or flexors? These are extensors. So all of these are extensors of the vertebral column. Okay. So that's the only one in this group. So you don't have to know intercostalis, spinalis, any of those. All of these right here you would just call the erector spinae, and the function would be for extension, right, of the vertebral column. Okay, here are some other muscles for breathing. The most important one is the diaphragm. And the diaphragm is dome-shaped when it's relaxed. I don't know if I have a picture. Don't have a picture. All right, so if we just have an anterior view of somebody's chest right here, the diaphragm, when it's relaxed, is dome-shaped. And when it contracts, what happens to the diaphragm? It goes flat. And so the volume of the thorax, for one reason, increases. How much did it increase? It increases by this volume right here. Right? So when the diaphragm contracts, the size of the thoracic cavity increases. And when that happens, guess what happens to air? It goes in your lungs. So that inflates your lungs. All right? What else happens? This is where the thoracic cage was in this diagram right here. Okay. See this volume right here? That's the volume in the lateral aspect and anterior aspect that your thoracic cavity increases as well. All right, so again, that's going to cause inspiration, air flowing in your lungs. And these muscles, I gave you a hint on some muscles that elevate the rib cage. What are some muscles that elevate the rib cage? Were the scalenes, right, because they're attached to rib number 1 and number 2. That elevates the rib cage, the diaphragm also increases the thoracic cage, and you inspire as a result. And the other muscles that elevate the rib cage are the external intercostals. So the function of external intercostals is for, if it elevates, like the scalenes, if that enlarges your thoracic cavity, the external intercostals are for inspiration. Externals are for inspiration. And the reason why this lifts the rib cage is because they're pulling on, for instance, first and second rib. What's holding the first and second rib in position or elevating them, lifting them up? It's the scalene muscles. Okay, so the intercostals are pulling the ribs up because they're actually pulling on the scalenes. All right, now, for expiration, there are two ways that air leaves our lungs. One is what we call quiet breathing, and the other is under forced breathing, when we're exercising. Quiet breathing is what you're doing right now. All right, so take a deep breath, just as a little exercise, and then relax. What happens? Does air move one way or another in your body? Take a deep breath and relax. What happened? What happened to you when you relaxed after a deep inspiration? Which way did air go? Did it stay in your lungs? No. It actually left your body. Right? So under quiet breathing, the way that you expire is just a passive process, just by relaxation. You don't need muscles to expire. Right? So what could you use to tell me why it is that you're expiring when you relax? What is a property of muscle? It is? Muscles are, they're excitable, you can get them to contract. You can stretch them, they're extensible. But when you relax a muscle, what happens to it? It goes back to its original location, which means what? The elastic properties. Muscle has elastic properties. So when you relax the external intercostals and you relax the diaphragm, guess what happens? Your rib cage depresses and the diaphragm goes from flat to dome-shaped, and that does what? That forces air out of your lungs. Your lung tissue is also very elastic. So as you inhale, you stretch your lungs, it's elastic tissue, and then when you relax those muscles, the lungs actually squeeze air out of the lungs as a result of their elastic properties. Okay. The second kind of breathing that you have is when you're hyperventilating or maybe when you're exercising. We call that forced breathing. And in order to move air in and out of your lungs very rapidly, you have to use some other muscles to expire. All right, so air doesn't move fast enough just by the elastic properties of muscles when you're breathing heavily. And the internal intercostals pull the rib cage down and in. So that helps with expiration, but not under quiet breathing. That's under what we call forced breathing. All right, so you can force a lot of air out of your lungs. So you're using your internal intercostals to compress your thoracic cavity. All right, some other muscles that you can use for forced breathing. And they're going to decrease the volume of the thoracic cavity. All right, so those are all the muscles of the abdomen, abdominal muscles. So when they contract, that squishes down the abdomen, but what do you have in your abdominal cavity? All kinds of junk in there, right? You've got stomach and liver and spleen. So you got a lot of organs in this region right here, and when you squish the abdominal cavity, guess where they go? They move up, okay? And then that helps to what? To then force the diaphragm into an even more dome shape, which then forces air out of your body. So muscles of forced expiration are all the abdominal muscles because they compress the abdominal compartments up into the thoracic cavity, forcing air out of your lungs. So what are some muscles of the abdominal cavity? Rectus abdominis, okay, as well as all of the oblique muscles, like the transverse abdominis, the internal oblique and external oblique, all can be used for forced expiration as well as for posture. All right, so these are all flexors of the vertebral column, but they're also important for forced expiration. So that's the importance of the abdominal muscles. Okay, so on the test, you should be able to name all of these different muscles right here. All right, let's look at the shoulder a little bit, and in particular, muscles around that originate on the scapula. All right, so here's the spine of the scapula right here, and this is the posterior part of the scapula. We got two important muscles on the posterior scapula. Here's the supraspinatus, which is above the spine. Here is the infraspinatus, that's underneath the spine of the scapula. They go across the shoulder joint, all right, into the posterior humerus. And then here is the teres minor, right, which comes from the lateral margin of the scapula into the posterior part of the humerus. So let's look at the infraspinatus and the teres minor right here. And this one right here is the teres major. But I want to focus on the teres minor because it inserts what? On the posterior humerus. So for instance, when the infraspinatus contracts and the teres minor contracts, what's going to happen to the humerus? It's pulling down the posterior part. So that's going to pull the posterior part of the humerus which way? Medially. It's going to pull it into midline. And the motion that produces is what? A lateral rotation of the humerus, because it's pulling on the back part, a lateral rotation of the humerus. And you can see that the tendons of the infraspinatus and the teres minor, as well as the supraspinatus right here, go across the shoulder joint, which is a pretty complicated joint, and it's a synovial joint, so there's a fibrous capsule. These tendons then participate in making the structure of the fibrous capsule. And so these muscles right here are three of the four muscles that make up the rotator cuff, because it's important for what? Rotating the humerus, especially a lateral rotation. The other muscle that's important for making up the rotator cuff is the muscle on the anterior side of the scapula. What's that fossa on the anterior side of the scapula called? Can you remember what the anterior side was called? The subscapular fossa, right? Subscapular fossa. And so there's an important muscle there. Guess what the name of that muscle is in the subscapular fossa? That's the subscapularis. All right, and so that's the fourth muscle that makes up the rotator cuff that's important for lateral rotation of the humerus. So, rotator cuff. The four muscles. Subscapularis is one. The infraspinatus. All right, the teres. Now, which one? Okay, let's take a look at the slide right here. Okay, look where that teres major goes. All right, it's way inferior to the teres minor. It goes across the shoulder joint, but it really doesn't participate in making up the fibrous capsule of the shoulder. All right, so the teres major is not part of the rotator cuff because the insertion is too inferior. The one that makes the rotator cuff is the more superior one, which is the teres minor. All right, so teres minor. All right, and then one last one. The supraspinatus. All right, so if we look at these right here, that sort of spells something that almost makes sense, okay? That spells what? At SITS, S-I-T-S. Those are the muscles whose tendons reinforce the fibrous capsule of the shoulder. So when somebody has a rotator cuff injury, it includes what? Pretty much all of those different insertions of those different muscles right there. And here we have some examples of some fixator muscles. All right, what shape is a rhomboid? It's kind of square. It's a four-sided figure that's kind of square, but it can be a little bit angulated. So here's the rhomboid major. Here's the rhomboid minor. And the levator scapulae. These are muscles that hold the scapula in position so that, what, the biceps and triceps can work properly. So these are some good examples of fixator muscles. Let's see, what muscles in the forearm do you guys have to know? You have to know brachioradialis. Okay, I think you have to know pronator teres. Guess which motion the pronator teres? It produces pronation. Right, flexor carpi radialis, palmaris longus, that works all the way up on the digits over here, and the flexor carpi ulnaris. So those are pretty easy to see. I don't think in lab we're going to ask you for any deep muscles of the forearm. Okay, for instance, like the flexor pollicis longus. Pollicis just means that it is attaching to the thumb, for instance. All right, but these are the ones that you have to know in the lab. Brachioradialis, pronator teres, flexor carpi radialis, palmaris longus, and flexor carpi ulnaris. So probably the easiest way to know that is by just memorizing what order you find these muscles in. Okay, that's the best way to do it. All you have to do then is find one. So brachioradialis is the only one that actually goes across the elbow. So start with that one. And then the same for the posterior arm. All right, we have extensor carpi, longus. I don't think you have to know supinator. You have to know the flexor digitorum superficialis. And I think that's probably about it for lab, and none of the deeper muscles. And no muscles of the hand. All right, now the muscles, though, across the hip, you do have to know, and thigh. And this group right here, the psoas, right, have two origins from the transverse processes of the lumbar vertebrae, or the ilium, right, and then it inserts into the greater trochanter of the femur, right, so that's going to flex your thigh. So these are important forearm thigh flexors. Yeah. I think you just need one because you get to write in. Yeah, so just choose one. That makes sense. Okay, so probably the most important thing to realize, though, is that these are what? Flexors of the hip. Important flexors of the hip. These are the ones that are kind of abused when somebody's trying to do sit-ups to strengthen their abdominal muscles, because a lot of times when you do a sit-up, you're doing hip flexion. All right, and if you don't do it right, these are the muscles that you actually exercise and not your abdominal muscles. So when you're doing sit-ups to improve your abdominal muscles, probably your back really shouldn't really come way up off the floor, because then you're just flexing at the hip. Okay, here's part of the quadriceps muscles, vastus lateralis, okay, the rectus femoris, and the medialis. Do you see the medialis anywhere? Probably right here. The intermedius is too deep, so we can't really see it. So these primarily are extensors of the leg because they insert into the patella. The only other interesting thing is that the rectus femoris right here does work across the hip, and it can also cause flexion of the hip as well. Okay, and then the insertion of the quadriceps finally is into the tibial tuberosity on the tibia. Okay, all of these muscles right here are adductors. All right, so you just have to memorize which ones come next to each other, starting maybe laterally. All right, the gracilis, adductor magnus is deep, adductor longus. All right, and pectineus, I don't know if you have to know pectineus in lab. All right, and for instance, here is an abductor, the tensor fascia lata. All right, so it's a really short muscle, but it inserts into the iliotibial tract or iliotibial band that goes all the way down into the knee. So that's not a very powerful muscle because we don't use that much in stabilizing our gait. All right, posterior leg, maybe a little bit more complicated. All right, so here is gluteus maximus, gluteus medius, a little bit more anterior and deep to it, but we have all of the muscles of the hamstring group. All right, so what did we say the motion of the anterior thigh was? For? Extension of the leg. So muscles of the posterior leg are going to be flexion of the leg. So the hamstrings are for flexion. All right, so when I look at this, the most medial muscle that we're going to look at is the semimembranosus right here. All right, and then the semitendinosus, which is superficial to it. And then laterally, we have the biceps. So going from medial to lateral, you got the semimembranosus, the semitendinosus, and the biceps femoris. All right, so how can you remember that the semimembranosus is the medial hamstring? Because of, when I see it, I just see membranosus, there's a nice big M and membranosus, and there's an M in medial. All right, so don't get confused. The biceps is going to be the lateral hamstring, the membranosus is the medial, and the semitendinosus just has this nice long tendon coming off of it. So membranosus, tendinosus, biceps femoris. That's easy to see. Okay. I think that's all I'm going to say about muscles, but I can't overemphasize again how important it is to know muscle action by body compartment. Okay? So you do have some slides here to look at from that standpoint. All right, so let's see. Muscles of inspiration. What are some muscles for inspiration? Scalenes. Anything that elevates the rib cage. Okay, and what's another important for inspiration? It has to do with the rib cage. It is the intercostals? It's the external intercostals are important for inspiration. And then the most important for inspiration is the diaphragm. Okay, now what about for forced breathing, expiration for forced breathing? You have the internal intercostals and then the abdominal muscles, rectus and all the oblique muscles. Now, what about for quiet breathing, quiet expiration? What muscles do you need for quiet breathing, expiration? Okay, that's for inspiration, but for quiet expiration, what muscles do you need? It's a trick question. You don't need any, it's passive. So the way that air leaves your lungs passively for quiet breathing is just by utilizing the elastic properties of the diaphragm, okay, and the intercostals and the elastic properties of lung tissue by itself. Okay, let's see what else. Okay, then you just have to practice labeling these diagrams that you have for the test. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much it for today.